Jewish Audio on Kabod.org.
This class is presented by Rabbi Nissen David Dubov, Director of Chabad, South London, England.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This evening is part 9 of our course on Jewish history, the period of the Second Temple. Now, the Second Temple actually stood for 420 years, 10 years more than the First Temple stood for. And that period of history is very much a story of survival from the spiritual onslaught of two great empires, one the Greek Empire and the other the Roman Empire. And I'd like to start this evening by talking about institutionalized Judaism, which was very much shaped by a body of men called the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. In English, they're called the Men of the Great Assembly. A Knesset, in fact, comes from the word kinus, which means a gathering of. A kinus is a gathering, and a Knesset is an assembly. Now, the word is quite familiar to us because, in fact, the modern-day Knesset in Israel, which in fact has 120 members, is modeled on the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, on the Men of the Great Assembly. Who were these people? The reference to them we find, in fact, in the Mishnah, which was the oral law recorded in writing only, in fact, in Roman times. But it says there, Moshe kibbal Torah miSinai, Moses received the tradition from Sinai, u'mesara liYehoshua, he gave it over to Joshua. Joshua gave it over to the elders gave it over to the prophets, and the prophets gave it over to the men of the great assembly. Who were these men? They were a group of 120 great sages and prophets who convened for about 30 years, from the years 3370 to 3400. It was established by Ezra, and it included great prophets such as Malachi, Zechariah, Haggai, and of course Mordechai and Daniel. Mordechai of the famed Purim story. The very last of these men of the Great Assembly was a man called Shimon HaTzadik, Simon the Just. Later on, in fact, in history, this group, which was the supreme lawmaking group, was in fact cut down in number to 71 people, and that supreme court was given a Greek name, the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is in fact a Greek word which reflects the idea of a Knesset, of an assembly of men. But in fact, that Greek word stuck, and even the Talmud has a tractate called Tractate Sanhedrin, which discusses the laws of courts, judges, and witnesses. What did these men do, and how did they influence Jewish life? In truth, it may be said that this was the most influential group that ever convened and enacted laws and customs which reverberate even today. How so? Let's start off with the Bible itself. Who made the Bible? Well, who wrote the Bible, we know. The five books of Moses were written by Moses as dictated by God. The book of Joshua was written by Joshua. The book of the Judges, some people say it was Samuel who wrote, and so too the book of Samuel up to a certain point. Course, that were after Samuel's demise, other prophets finished it. Thereafter you had the book of Kings and so on and so forth, and the writings of King David, the Psalms, they were written, we know, who authored the books. However, it was this men of the great assembly who, excuse the term, canonized all these books and collected them in what we know as the Tanakh. Tanakh, each letter, Taf, Nun, Kaf, Taf standing for Torah, the five books of Moses, Nun standing for Nevi'im, the prophets, and Kaf standing for Ketuvim, the writings. So you've got the five books of Moses, the Nevi'im, the prophets. Those are prophets ranging from, you've got from the book of Joshua, the book of Samuel, the book of Kings, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Haggai, until the last prophets, which in fact lived in this period. The very last of the prophets, in fact, the era of prophecy ended with the men of the great assembly. After that, there were no known prophets. There was divine inspiration, and perhaps in a different shiur we will discuss the difference between Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration, and prophecy. However, the prophets who actually came and said God has delivered a message which I need to deliver to the people, this era of prophecy ended with the men of the great assembly. These were the last of the prophets. Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi were the last of the prophets. And their works were canonized and edited and included in the Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. Now, the Ketuvim are the writings such as the Megillot, the five scrolls. Of course, one of the last of the scrolls was the scroll of Esther. This was Esther's request that the story of Purim be written in a scroll and in fact included in the writings. Mordechai was one of the men of the great assembly. And they, if you want, closed the Bible. What we know as the Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim, of course, Jews don't talk of the Old Testament because that implies that there's a New Testament. We don't believe in the New Testament. The one and only Testament, or what we refer to as the Tanakh, was in fact closed by them. So it became part of Jewish life to study these works. I must say that there are some works which were rejected and were not included. We'll come back to those a little later. This is one thing that the men of the great assembly did. Another thing. Since the days of Moses, it was instituted that the Torah be read in public every 3 days. There should not go by 3 days without studying or hearing a Devar Torah, a word of Torah. Moses instituted that the Torah be read on Shabbat morning, Shabbat afternoon, Mondays and Thursdays. But what was read, how much was read, and the content was not institutionalized. Then you had to read, but what was read was not fixed. It was the men of the great assembly that fixed the readings for the yearly cycle in which we would start and finish the Torah in a 1 year cycle. In fact, we start and finish on the same day, on Simchas Torah. That's the day that we actually start and finish the Torah, and that is why it's called Simchas Torah. It's the Simcha of the Torah that we're finishing it. He's the Chosim Torah, the person who's called up, and the Chosim Bereishis, the person who starts, is called the Chosim Bereishis. They also fix the Parshiot, the what we call as the Sedras, the order of the Sedra, and in fact split up the Parsha into seven sections, so that on Shabbat we would call up seven people to read the Torah. In the days of old, every person who was called up to the Torah, the reason why we use the term Aliyah is both in the physical and in the spiritual sense. In the physical sense, the Torah was read on a bima, on a elevated section in the synagogue, and therefore you had to go up on it in order to, when you were called up. And the other reason is, spiritually, it was considered an elevation in order to be called up to the reading of the Torah. The order of calling up, first a Kohen, then a Levite, then an Israelite, and the preferences that were given between Israelites themselves was fixed by the men of the Great Assembly. And thereafter, until today, that institution exists and is alive. They instituted Purim as a festival. Purim, story, had in fact just happened in their days. Mordechai was a man, and he was one of the men of the Great Assembly. And it was he, together with Esther, requested that the festival of Purim should be instituted as we do celebrate it today, in the reading of the Megillah, the giving of Mishloach Monos, and gifts to the poor, and having a festive meal. Perhaps, however, the most significant of the institutions of the men of the Great Assembly was the following. Prayer. Where does it say in the Bible we should pray? Where does it say in the Bible we should pray? So if you have a look in the Chumash, there is a verse which says, "Ula'avdoi b'chol levavachem." You should serve the Almighty with all your heart. Says the Talmud, "Ezu avoda shebelev." What is considered service of the heart? Zu tefillah. This is prayer. It's a service of the heart. Who was the first Jew who prayed? Now, if we're talking about communication with God, well, Adam communicated, Noah communicated, Abraham communicated. Who prayed? So the Talmud tells us that it was Abraham who instituted that we should pray the morning prayer, Vayashkem Avraham Avoker. Abraham rose early in the morning to pray. It was Isaac who instituted that we should pray in the afternoon, Vayetze Yitzchak Lasuach Basoda. Isaac went out to meditate or to pray in the field. That was at the time of the afternoon, in the afternoon, Mincha. And it was Jacob who instituted the evening prayer. So it was an ancient custom to pray three times a day, to commune with God. However, from the times of the patriarchs right until the times of the men of the Great Assembly, there was no specific text of the prayer. The people who lived in the land of Israel, of course, were fluent in Hebrew. And they prayed fluently, requesting as they saw fit whatever they needed. The most eloquent prayer we have expressed in the book of Samuel by Hannah, when she prayed beautifully in the tabernacle when she was requesting a son who eventually became Shmuel. That's called Tefillas Hannah, the prayer of Hannah. In fact, the Talmud derives many of the laws of prayer from how Hannah prayed and the content of what she prayed for. In other words, the men of the Great Assembly analyzed the tefillah, the prayer of Hannah, and they drew their conclusions as to what to include in the text from her prayer. But nobody had a fixed text of prayer. The problem was that when the Jews were exiled to Babylon, the spoken language was not Hebrew, it was Aramaic. And the Jews longed for a substitute for the temple service. The temple service had its own collection of prayers, of psalms which were recited. For example, even today, we say when we talk about the daily psalms which were mentioned in the temple, we say Hayoim Yoim Rishon B'Shabbos. Today is the first day of Shabbos. Shaboy Hayu Halavim Ma'imur B'Mis Hamikdash. And this is the psalm which the Levites sang in the temple on the first day of the week. And we say a certain psalm, one of the psalms, and that was accompanied by music and musical instruments and singing. The Levites and priests had their own text of prayers which they used in the temple. That had been destroyed, and the people in Babylon were longing for a substitute. Came along the men of the great assembly, because of these two reasons, because of the lack of the fluency in the mother tongue Hebrew, and because they needed a substitute. And what they did is they said, okay, look, we have a custom of praying three times a day. Now we are going to institutionalize a text to that prayer. And they formulated a prayer which we know today as the Shemona Esrei, the 18 blessings, the Amida, the silent prayer which is said standing. The word Amida means standing, quietly, facing Jerusalem, because in Babylon they focused their hearts and minds towards Jerusalem. They were waiting for the day when they would be able to return. And even today, wherever we are in the world, we face Jerusalem, and if you're in Jerusalem, we face the temple. And if you're in the temple, you face the Holy of Holies. We call it Mizrach. Here it's east. In England, in fact, it's better southeast. That would be more exact. In fact, the Shul Baruch Hashem now is actually facing southeast, exactly that way. So we're facing now the right, or at least you're facing the right direction. This was their institution, the Shemona Esrei, and a great institution it was. By the way, many people were not fluent in Hebrew, and therefore they instituted another thing, and that is there should be a Shaliach Tzibur, an emissary of the congregation, so that if the congregation itself does not know Hebrew, that person would lead the prayers. And so we have, if you want, a two-tier system. Those who knew the prayers prayed, and thereafter there was the repetition of the prayer for those who were not fluent. And that system still remains today. Another interesting thing which they instituted. It says in the Bible you should read the Shema in the morning and in the evening, something we all do. We read the Shema upon rising and before we go to bed. The men of the Great Assembly instituted the following. Look, you've got to read the Shema in the morning and the evening, yes? And we've just said you've got to pray in the morning and the evening. Do both together. They juxtaposed the two and said, first read the Shema and then pray, both in the morning and in the evening. And hence, in Shacharis and in Maariv, you've got the Shema before the Shemona Esrei. And the Shema was the meditation upon the unity and omnipresence of God. That was the best preparation to the request and the prayer of the Amida. And those institutions lasted for hundreds, and if not thousands of years. They last until today. In shuls today, the Amida, the Shemona Esrei, is repeated as a mantra almost, time and time again, every single day. And if we think of that, at that crucial point of history it was instituted, it's those prayers which are set in the minds and hearts of the Jewish people which have in fact have lifted us above the most difficult times of the exile. Two more things which I'd like to mention about the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, this men of the Great Assembly. They also fixed Hebrew writing. Now this may seem funny to you, but there were many scrolls around at the time, and many different types of writing. There was the Hebraic script. There is, in fact, an excellent book on this subject written by a man called Rabbi Menachem Kasher. It's almost a nice encyclopedia on the subject, where you have also pictures of fragments of early scrolls of that period. And you see that the writing of the period, just like today we have what we call blocks, and then we have script, Well, they had many different types of scripts, and of course the scrolls of those periods, some were written in this script and others written in that. They instituted that the Sefer Torah itself should be written in Ketav Ashuri, in Assyrian script. Now there is a difference of opinion as to what the word Ashuri means. Some people say it means, or it comes from the word Syria, Assyrian. However, other people say it comes from the word Ashur or Ashrei, praised. It's the most praiseworthy script. And in fact, tradition has it that this is the script which the original five books of Moses was written, the block, and the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the men of the Great Assembly, fixed it that all scrolls, all Sifrei Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzahs should be written in that script. And the early fragments, which we do have, the Qumran scrolls and so on and so forth, all employ the Assyrian script. And therefore what is beautiful about today's Sefer Torah is that the letters which we have today in the Sefer Torah can be recognized by any Cheder child who's learned the block, whereas take the Magna Carta, for example, or any very early document of the of historic nature, often contemporary people cannot recognize even the shapes of the letters. Whereas since the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the men of the Great Assembly, institutionalized the Ketav Ashur, the Assyrian script, as being the script in which scrolls were to be written, that has allowed us unanimity, right the way through history, that we have this golden chain of just having that one script, which although we've used other forms of handwriting, for example, if you have a look in the Rashi's time, Rashi's form of handwriting is much different than our form of handwriting today. The different styles of handwriting has changed, but the script used in the main books has not. Finally, one thing which they introduced were things called siyogim. You'll find this in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. It says, Vasu siyog la Torah. Make a fence around the Torah. And what that means is as follows. The men of the Great Assembly understood that although there are 613 commandments, not to be added upon, nor to be detracted, however, it was important that in order to guard people from near transgression, it was necessary to create a fence which would save them from falling off the cliff. And in order to do that, they made certain enactments. Let's take, for example, the laws of Shabbat. On Shabbos, we know, you're not supposed to write. You're not supposed to pick a pen up and write. So the rabbis made a siyog, they made a fence. This was called mukta. Mukta means things which are prohibited to be touched on Shabbos, or moved on Shabbos. For example, they said, don't move a pen. Don't pick a pen up. Do you know why? Because most probably, if you'll pick a pen up, you will write with it. So, to write with a pen, this is prohibited biblically. Mid-o-raisa. That's an important word, by the way. De-o-raisa is an Aramaic word which means of biblical origin. It's split up into two words which means or-yesa. Yesa means in Aramaic, it brings, and or is light. It brings light, it illuminates. That means the five books of Moses, Oraisa. However, mukta, not moving the pen or not picking the pen up, is only osur, forbidden, midrabonon, rabbinically. And therefore we have starting already numerous rabbinic enactments. These were brought into focus by the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. And the truth is, there's a saying in the Talmud, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Makdim Refuah Lemacha, which means, the Almighty brings the cure before the disease. And certainly this was the case at this period in the Jewish history, because it was through these institutions of the men of the Great Assembly that saved the Jewish people from complete assimilation under the Greeks, as we shall soon see. Unlike in the First Temple period, when the main problems that the people, spiritual problems which were dealing with, was idolatry, in the Second Temple period it wasn't so much idolatry, but it was oppression. The Jews wanted to serve the one God, however, they were infiltrated by foreign philosophies, philosophies foreign to Judaism, and which Judaism found foreign to them, to it. And, as we'll soon talk in a minute, the people were invaded by Hellenism. Now, I mentioned beforehand that the last of the men of the Great Assembly was a man called Shimon HaTzadik, Simon the Just. He, in historic terms, could also be called the first of the generations of Tanoim. Now that is an important word, because when you learn Mishnah and Talmud, the people whom you come across will be divided into two: Tanoim and Amoraim. Tanoim, these are the people who compiled and contributed to the Mishnah. The Mishnah being the first time the oral tradition was ever written down by Judah the prince, and this was in Roman times. And the first, if you want, of the period of Tanoim was Shimon HaTzadik, Simon the Just. Post-Mishnaic times, in Talmudic times, the rabbis were referred to as Amoraim. Shimon was a Kohen, he was a priest, and he served as a high priest for 40 years. He is famed to have said, on three things does the world stand: on Torah, on meaning Torah learning, on Avodah, on prayer, Val Gemilas Chasadim, and on acts of kindness. He traveled the country, he set up schools, he was a great sage, and really he perpetuated the work of the men of the Great Assembly. He fortified Jerusalem. He built a beautiful water conduit from the Shiloah pool right inside the temple. In his days, we're told, miraculous things happened. One of them being that on Yom Kippur, a red thread was hung outside the temple, and it turned white as a symbol of the people's repentance. And the menorah, the candelabrum inside the temple, its neir tamid, it had a continual light which miraculously burned for 24 hours, whereas the actual measurement of oil which went in the menorah only burned for 12 hours, whereas the miraculously one of those flames burned continually. This was at certain times in the temple times when the people merited, this miracle took place. And in fact, that is one of the reasons that just outside of the Ark of the Holy Ark, in most synagogues, there is a light, a continual flame, which is called the Neir Tamid, the continual light, which shines just outside the Ark to remind us of this miracle. Now, at that time in history, great political upheavals were taking place in the world as well. If you remember, the Jews were allowed to come back to the land of Israel by Cyrus, and thereafter by Darius. And at this stage in history, however, the Persian Empire was being threatened by a new empire, the Empire of Greece. And it came to its fore in the person of Alexander of Macedonia, Alexander Mokdon. And he sent a message to Shimon HaTzadik, to Simon the Just, that now, instead of paying the tribute, the tax to Persia, it was to be paid to him. Shimon sent a message back of refusal. Alexander was absolutely infuriated by this refusal, and he marched on Jerusalem, coming down through Gaza, with the intent to destroy. And a beautiful story took place. We're told that Shimon HaTzadik went out to meet Alexander in full regalia. He donned his clothes of the high priest, which were very beautiful, and took out the priests and Sifrei Torah with him. And he went out to meet Alexander on his way into Jerusalem. And when Alexander saw him, he gave him great honor. When Alexander saw Shimon HaTzadik, he gave him great honor. And Alexander's generals could not understand why he had given this Jew such great honor when, after all, he'd refused him. And Alexander said the reason was because whenever he went out to battle, he dreamed the night beforehand, and in his dream he saw the vision of this man come and promising him success in his battles. And when he saw him, he recognized him as the one who had come to him in his dream, and therefore respected and knew him to be a man of God, a just and a true man. And in fact, he is referred to in history as Shimon HaTzadik, Simon the Just. Alexander was so impressed by the temple that he allowed the Jews to continue to practice as beforehand and did not at all interfere with any of their customs or Torah practices. But he wanted one thing. He said, "I'll ask only one thing of you, and that is I would like to have an image of me erected inside the temple courts." Shimon HaTzadik explained to him that this cannot be done, because the Jews would deem that as idolatrous. But instead, this was perhaps quick thinking or divine inspiration on the part of Shimon HaTzadik, he said, "Instead we'd like to give you even a greater honor. And the greater honor is that every single child, male child, that is to be born in this coming year will be named Alexander after you." And thus crept in to the Jewish dictionary of names the name Alexander. And in fact, the name Sender or Sander is a short of Alexander or Alex, and so on and so forth. It is a Greek name. How did it get in? This was because of Shimon HaTzadik's gesture to Alexander. Alexander accepted it and was happy with that. Now, great was the influence of the Greeks. The language of the educated became Greek. Aristotle was the school teacher of Alexander, and Greek ideology became widespread. Alexander was kind to the Jews. He exempted them, for example, from paying a tax in the Shemitah, in the sabbatical year, when they weren't working on the land. Those soldiers who were employed in, those Jewish soldiers who were employed in his army, he freed them from working on the Shabbos. The only problem with Alexander, I'm painting perhaps a too nice a picture of Alexander. In his other campaigns, he was known not exactly to be he was known to be quite ruthless, actually, in his campaigns. But in as far as Jewish history is concerned, we must say that he dealt very fairly with the Jewish people. In fact, the Talmud tells us an incredible story of how there were a few nations, including the Egyptians, that challenged the right of the Jews to live in the land, and a debate was organized by Alexander, and in these debates the Jews were successful in persuading him of their position, and he was quite kind and benevolent to the Jews. The problem with him was that he died, and he died when he was very young. He died at the age of 33, and his huge empire collapsed and died with him. We'll speak a little bit more about that in a minute. Greek influence continued. Greek names, apart from Alexander, creeped into the lexicon of Jewish names. Joshua, Yehoshua, became Jason. The Knesset, the Beit Knesset, something which we'd always called the House of Gathering, the Beit Knesset, became synagogue, a Greek word. And of course the council, the Anshei Knesset, the men of the Knesset, became a Sanhedrin. The Tanoim, the leading rabbis and sages in Israel, of course opposed this Greek influence. Alexander's generals divided the empire between them. Ptolemy, now when I say the word Ptolemy, there were in fact a whole succession of Ptolemies, kings or great generals of Egypt. Ptolemy the First, Soter, that was his name, he extended his influence over Judea. One of Alexander's generals called Ptolemy, he took to Judea and Egypt. Seleucus was another of Alexander's generals. He took control over Syria and Asia Minor. Ptolemy again was good to the Jews as long as they paid their tax. He left the Sanhedrin to be the supreme court and rule on all Jewish matters. And the head of the Sanhedrin was a man called the Nossi, the prince, and below him, second in command, was a man called the Av Beis Din. And even today, in a Beis Din, there are those two terms. You have the Rosh Beis Din, the head of the Beis Din, and the Av Beis Din, the father of the Beis Din. In fact, here in London, the Rosh Beis Din is the chief rabbi, the Av Beis Din is Dein Erzrabbi. So those two terms which you have from the times of the Sanhedrin stuck, and even now. The Sanhedrin sat in a semicircular stone semicircle inside the temple. It was a court called the Lishkas HaGozis, the hewn courtyard, because this semicircle of stone was hewn out, literally. And the reason it was in a semicircle was because all the 70 of them would sit and all of them could see any litigant who came before them. There was an order in which they used to judge. In civil cases, it started with the top people and went down to their underlings. In capital cases, it started with the underlings and worked the way to the middle. The other generals of Alexander were good to the Jews, and Jewish communities developed also outside of the land of Israel. The largest and most influential of those cities that developed outside of the land of Israel was Alexandria in Egypt, and it became a center of world trade. The Jews of Alexandria built a magnificent shul. In fact, the Talmud tells us that in this shul in Alexandria, it was absolutely huge, and it had a section for each trade. So all the cobblers would sit in one section, all the doctors in another, all the tradesmen in another, and of course that was good for business. Luckily enough, the shul was so big you couldn't hear the chazan, so they had time to do some business, I presume, on the side. And if they needed, it was so big, they needed a man to stand on the bimah with a flag. So whenever the chazan would say, Yizkadosh Shmei Rabbi, he would say Kaddish, the man would wave the flag and everyone would say Amen. Might be a good idea to do that in some of our shuls today. The idea of a maturgamon was instituted, meaning a translator. Now this is an interesting one. Perhaps again we should revert back to this nowadays, although there is a ruling today which we say Chodesh Asim in HaTorah, new innovations are not keenly looked upon. But in those days, the reader used to read a verse from the Torah, let's say in Hebrew, and then it was immediately translated. So the people knew what they were talking about. You could argue today with printed books, since we have translations you can read the translation as the reader is reading the original Hebrew. But then, in fact, it used to be translated. The problem with all this was that the people in Alexandria took such a keen interest in Greek culture and started studying the works of the Greek philosophers of Plato and Aristotle, that even the Jewish philosophers who were writing works of explanatory works on the Bible became influenced by their Greek contemporaries, and in fact sometimes used Greek ideas to express themselves. The second Ptolemy, who was called Philadelphus, he continued to maintain a warm attitude towards the Jews. He was a great friend of books, and he built a gigantic library. And he approached the then high priest in Israel called Elazar to send him 70 sages who were all well versed in Greek in order to translate the Bible. When these 70 sages arrived in Egypt, Ptolemy separated them all, put them into different cubicles where they could not communicate one with each other. And he asked them all to translate the Bible. And a miracle happened, that they all translated exactly the same. And Talmai was so impressed by this miracle, he saw the Kedusha, he saw the holiness, both of the text and also of the people who wrote it. Now you may have heard of the word Septuagint. The word for 70 in Latin is Septuagint. And of course this was the first time that a translation of the Bible was made into a different language. Uncas, who translated the Bible into Aramaic, lived later. He lived in Roman times. So in fact the Aramaic translation was made later. The earliest translation was made into Greek. And this Septuagint contained not only all the books of the Bible, but also what is known as the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha are certain books, the book of Tobias and the book of Judith, which were not included, for various reasons, inside our Tanakh. And in fact, most of the original works in Hebrew we don't even have nowadays. We only have their translation into Greek. Now, was this looked upon favorably or not by the sages? And the answer was yes and no. On the one hand, the Jews now had a translation which they could all relate to, because the intelligentsia spoke Greek, and they could now delve into the Bible in the language that was understood by them. However, the sages, the Tanoim, in the land of Israel and the Sanhedrin frowned upon it, and they tried to eliminate its usage in the land of Israel, because they wanted to hold on to the original Hebrew. They didn't want these inroads. Now, I think you could see the front page of the Jewish Chronicle if it would have been printed in those days. You could see this running battle between, okay, come on, let's move on with the times. We're now in an enlightened era. This is an era where most people speak Greek. What is terrible, isn't it a tremendous advance that now the Bible has been translated into a language we can all understand? And there you have those old hardliners down in the Stamford Hills of downtown Jerusalem who are saying, no, we must hold on to our original Hebrew, and the Hebrew, the Lashon HaKodesh, must be the language which we must study the Bible. And in fact, this is how the political scene developed after the death of Shimon HaTzadik. The Jewish fabric of society started to be plagued by what we call Hellenism. Hellenism and Hellenists, people whom openly supported Greek culture, ideologies, and modes of living, came out openly to displace Jewish customs. At that time, a grandson of Shimon HaTzadik called Yochanan was the Kohen Gadol, and the treasurer of the temple was a man called Simon. He was a Hellenist, and he did a terrible thing. He went and denounced Yochanan, the high priest, to Seleucus, the Greek general who came after Alexander. This Seleucus dispatched his finance minister called Heliodorus to Jerusalem, and Simon had in fact told Seleucus that Yochanan, the high priest, was amassing a great sum of money for a rebellion. Heliodorus forced his way into the temple to see what funds had been amassed, and in fact he was only stopped by a holy apparition that stood in his way. Yochanan's own brother, a man called Yehoshua, changed his name to Jason. And when Yochanan was away, in fact he went to Antioch to complain about Heliodorus's terrible barging into the temple, Seleucus was murdered by Heliodorus's finance minister, and was succeeded, Seleucus was succeeded by a brother. Now this brother, I'm sure you've heard of him. His name was Antiochus Epiphanes. He was a great admirer of the Greeks. He was in fact brought up in Athens. And this Antiochus gave Jason full power to be the governor of Israel. And the reason was because he promised him more money, more tribute, more tax. Jason started to undermine the power of the sages, the power of the Sanhedrin, and to really cripple the spiritual fabric of the people. He built a huge gymnasium next to the temple where men would wrestle naked and do all sorts of things that the Greeks used to do. And the spiritual level of the people, unfortunately, went down. Now, Simon, who was the treasurer of the temple, he had a brother called Menelaus. And this Menelaus realized that Jason got the position of governor because he'd offered Antiochus a tax. So he thought, well, I'll play him at his own game. Menelaus went to Antiochus and offered him even a greater tax if he would appoint Menelaus as the new high priest. Well, that's exactly what Antiochus did. He was delighted at this play for power in Israel. He deposed Jason and he appointed Menelaus as the high priest. And the result, the net result, was that no longer did the people view the position of high priest as a sacred position, as a spiritual leader of the people, as it was in the days of Simon the Just. In other words, in the days of Shimon HaTzadik, the spiritual leader of the people was the Kohen Gadol. Now the people saw it as it was a money job. Who paid more for the position? Menelaus had a problem. Although he promised a huge sum of money to Antiochus, he couldn't afford it. And his inability to pay such a large tribute caused him to rob the temple of much of its treasure in order to pay, in order to maintain his position. And he was absolutely ruthless in obtaining the money. He even had the old high priest Yochanan, who was ousted, he had him murdered because he went to Antiochus to complain about it. Now, there were ongoing battles between the generals who have succeeded Alexander. There was an ongoing war, there was a battle between Antiochus Epiphanes and Ptolemy of Egypt. When I say Ptolemy of Egypt, I hear I'm not exact in saying which Ptolemy there were, because there was a whole roll of Ptolemies. If we wanted to be very exact, I could actually tell you his name and which, but for all intents and purposes, it doesn't mean much to our story, because we've got to move on to what means most to us at this particular stage, which is the Hanukkah story. Antiochus battled Ptolemy and was successful, but now a new power was raising its head and challenging everybody, the power of Rome. A rumor spread that in a battle Antiochus had died. Remember this displaced Jason I told you about beforehand? He thought, well, if Antiochus is now dead, I'm going to go and depose the fellow who deposed me, Menelaus. So he marched on Jerusalem with 1,000 men and intended to kill Menelaus. Antiochus, who actually wasn't dead, when he heard about it, he sent a huge army to attack Jerusalem because he saw that Jason's attempt to depose Menelaus was a direct rebuff against him. Antiochus came into Jerusalem. He killed 40,000 men. He emptied the temple of its treasure and committed terrible acts of sacrilege in the temple precincts. Jason fled and died in Sparta. Menelaus was eventually executed by the Syrian government. It can be said that these two, Jason and Menelaus, were two people who were chiefly responsible for the spiritual decline of the people, for setting up the high priesthood as a job that was bought, and of bringing Antiochus Epiphanes to ransack the temple. And we're now left in a position where Antiochus, so annoyed and so annoyed with the people in charge and with the Jews in general, that he set out to destroy the Jewish religion. Antiochus decreed any Jew found keeping the Shabbos would be put to death. An idol of Zeus was set up in the temple. Bris Milah, circumcision, was banned and scrolls burned. It was at this juncture that many Jews preferred death rather than desecrate the Holy Torah. The famous story of Hannah and her 7 sons, each of whom gave up their lives for the Torah, took place under this tyrant. Antiochus ordered his troops to set up idols in every single town. And it was in a small town, several miles north of Jerusalem, a town we all know today is so famous, and in fact today there's a beautiful city there, not a town anymore. In this town of Modi'in lived an old man called Matisyahu. He was a priest. He was from the family of Hashmonaim, Hasmoneans, and he had 5 sons. Their names were Yochanan, Shimon, Yehuda, Elazar, and Yonasan. When Apelles, a Syrian overseer, came to Modin and erected an idol to Jupiter, in the marketplace he instructed all the Jews to bow down to it. One Jew did. And Matisyahu, so incensed at this traitor, came and killed him for his desecration of God's name. He then instructed his sons to attack the Greek soldiers, at which they did, and they then fled to the hills. Matisyahu raised the call, "Mi Lashem Eli, whoever is for the Lord, come to me." And when the people heard of this act of resistance, it fanned the flames rather like in the Warsaw Ghetto, that the people decided we must resist, and hundreds fled to the hills and joined the band of the Hashmonaim. Guerrilla warfare ensued. And in fact, due to the rebellion, the faith of the Jews was strengthened. Matisyahu was an old man at the time, and before he died, he left in his last will and testament and told his sons, he urged them to clear the land of all this Greek idols, and he appointed his son Shimon as the spiritual successor, and his son Yehuda in charge of the army. Yehuda excelled. He first attacked in small groups, but eventually in open battle. He was always at the front of his troops. He had on his banner the word Maccabee. And the word Maccabee is in fact four letters meaning four different words. Mem means me. Kaf stands for Kamocha, who is like you. Bet stands for Ba'elim, amongst the mighty ones. Yud is the first letter of Hashem's four-letter name, Hashem. Who is like you amongst the mighty ones, O God? Maccabee. And some people say that Maccabee also is like the hammerer, because Yehuda hammered away at the Greeks. Antiochus was so incensed, he sent two generals, Siron and Apollonus. They were both attacked and annihilated by Yehuda. He sent a general called Lysias with a huge army of 40,000 infantry, 7,000 cavalry against 6,000 Jewish soldiers, totally outnumbered. Rabim biyad me'atim, many against a few. There were three generals who headed the army, Nicanor, Gorgias, and Ptolemy. And the Jewish army, unlike the Greek army before they went into battle, who drank the night before until intoxication, the Jewish army, as in the times of the prophet Samuel, gathered in the town of Mitzpah, and they prayed. They attacked at night, they routed the Syrian army, and annihilated it. And this was in the year 3622. They entered Jerusalem. There was still a significant but small enemy force outside Jerusalem in a citadel, but they entered the Jerusalem. They cleared the temple as they entered. They were distraught at what they saw. It took them an entire day to clear the temple. They dismantled the old altar and put its stones in a special room, because they needed a prophet to tell them what to do with it. The golden menorah had been stolen by the Greeks. They replaced it with an iron one, and then they wanted to rededicate or to kindle a flame inside the temple. And they wanted to do this with pure oil. A search was on for any pure oil which had the insignia of the high priest, which had not been defiled by the Greeks. And a miracle happened. They found a small cruse of oil which had the insignia of the high priest, which had not been defiled by the Greeks. And this oil, as you all know the story, was only enough to burn for one day. They placed it in the menorah, lit it, and a miracle happened that it lit for 8 days. This was the time that was needed for them to procure new oil for the menorah, new pure oil. And that took place on the 25th of Kislev in the year 3622. And the next year, the year after that, the sages instituted that we should have a national holiday, the holiday of Hanukkah. The holiday of Hanukkah celebrated by lighting a candle for 8 days on the 25th of Kislev. In fact, if you only have one candle to light, you only need light one candle. The halacha is Neir Ishu Beisei, it's enough for a man to light one candle in his household. Those, says the Talmud, who are more particular in beautifying the mitzvah should light one for each member of the household. However, if you wish to really beautify the mitzvah, you should light one candle for each day of Hanukkah. And there's an argument, according to the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai, should it be in an ascending or descending order. We rule according to the house of Hillel that it should be lit in an ascending order, and therefore, as we do, we light one the first night, two the second night, etc. And there was a special prayer instituted called the Al Hanisim prayer, which was to be inserted inside the Shemone Esrei, that prayer we have today. And in that prayer, it tells us of the great military victory that the Jews had against the Greeks, and of the spiritual victory of the spirit of the Jew against the onslaught of assimilation. Fortunately, at that moment, at that juncture in history, the Syrian Empire itself was torn by strife. Antiochus Epiphanes himself died insane, and Yehuda, his brothers and the army, freed many Jews from their captors. It was only a while later, however, that Lysias, this Syrian general, attacked again with a huge army, and this time he brought war elephants along with him. There is this story of how one of the brothers, called Elozar, of how Elozar died when he saw, he was trying to kill the Greek king, and he ran to the biggest war elephants and thrust his sword in the belly of the elephants. The elephants collapsed, rolling over, and killed both Elozar, and in fact it turned out it wasn't the king, but it was one of the top generals. But his heroism inspired the Jews to continue, although against all odds it was a losing battle. But news shortly came that in Antioch there was a rebellion. The Syrians had to retreat quickly, and they made a peace treaty with Yehuda Maccabee. And the Hasmoneans, the Hashmonaim, their hold was, if you want, complete. And for once, the Jews had wrestled themselves away from the Greek influence and had established again their position in the area. We're going to stop at this juncture this evening, but I'd like to make one final comment. As you, of course, now see, in history, the story of Purim came before the story of Hanukkah. The story of Purim took place at the end of the 70-year exile of the Jews in Babylon. The story of Hanukkah takes place some 100 and so years into the Second Temple, into the period of the Second Temple. And yet, there is a fascinating observation that in the Mishnah, which was the record of the oral tradition written in Roman times, there is great description of the story of Purim. There is a tractate in the Babylonian Talmud called Megillah. And yet, there is no or very little mention of the story of Hanukkah. And great sages were disturbed by this and asked, why is this so? And one of the answers perhaps given was that had the Jews at the times of the Romans written at length about the story of Hanukkah, it would have inspired their brethren to rebel, or may have been perceived as a rebellion by the Romans whom they were under, and therefore they couldn't write about it. Whereas in Persia, the story of Haman and so on and so forth was more a thriller, and it still left the Jews under the Persian rule at the end of the day. Whereas this heroic revolt of the Hashmonaim, although documented in the Talmud, we do find there's a few pages in Tractate Shabbat which talks about it, it wasn't mentioned in the Mishnah, or albeit it was, but tangentially. Hanukkah was the story of the attempt to destroy the Jewish spirit. Purim was the story of the attempt to destroy the Jewish body. In both cases, it was through great heroism, self-sacrifice, that the Jew surfaced and continued.